Thank you for inviting me. Today I'm going to give you an overview of magnetic and thermal studies we've been doing of Martian meteorites over the last five or six years, just about done now. As you know, Martian meteorites are rocks that have been naturally transferred from the surface of Mars to Earth following an impact on the Martian surface. And there are a few scraps of the planet, but we hope that there's something we might be able to learn about the history of past geophysical processes on Mars and planetary evolution from studying these things. And in particular, we've been interested in trying to understand the evolution of Martian magnetic fields and dynamo activity, the history of Martian surface temperatures and climate, and even maybe something about habitability of the planet in the past. Here is a picture of Mars, the big rock from which these things came from. Mars today is a cold and dry place. Surface temperature is around 6 millibar, about a 10,000th of the Earth's water in the atmosphere. Surface temperature is around minus 70 degrees C or so on average. Cold and dry place with water not even stable in liquid form on the surface. But it's pictures like these in the Martian southern hemisphere that came back to us from spacecraft like the Viking orbiter in the 1970s that have long suggested to researchers that Mars was once a very different place. You see here, there's lots of craters here, obviously, and there's an ancient population of fairly large craters that look quite degraded. So here's one. Some of them are barely whispers. It looks like they've been heavily modified by flow of fluids on the surface. And then sort of superimposed as kind of a palimpsest on that background of ancient craters is a fresh population of unmodified craters, which are younger. And the idea has always been, since people first saw these pictures, that early Mars might have been a warmer and wetter place, and that there's been subsequently something that changed the climate to the current cold and dry conditions. What caused that to occur is one of the biggest mysteries in Mars science, and it's mostly been ascribed to atmospheric loss, that there once was a thick early atmosphere that was subsequently lost. Another thing was lost from early Mars, and that is magnetic field. So turns out that this terrain that I'm showing you here sits right in the middle of one of these gigantic magnetic anomalies. This is basically intensity of magnetic field as mapped on the Martian surface. Actually, this is above the Martian surface. It doesn't matter where it is. The point is that there are very strong magnetic anomalies that originate from crustal magnetization in ancient terrains in the southern hemisphere. And Mars today does not have a global dynamo-driven magnetic field, but it's data like this which was acquired in the late 90s by the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft that suggested that early Mars may have, in fact, had a global magnetic field, which is responsible for this remnant magnetization you see here. Now, our best understanding of the atmosphere gases are lost from the surface of the Martian atmosphere is that the solar wind is responsible for removing heavy elements. And if there was a magnetic field on early Mars, it would have protected the atmosphere from loss by the impingement of the solar wind. So it's possible that the change in climate on Mars was tied, in fact, to the loss of an early intense magnetic field. Of course, there are many, many questions associated with this. Here's just a few. When was there a field on Mars, and how strong was it? Did atmospheric loss result from the loss of magnetic field? When and how much of that atmosphere was lost? Was climate change on Mars really a result of atmospheric loss at all? Was Mars even warmer and wetter than it was? I mean, that's what people have inferred from these images and other data as well. But is it really true that really Mars was, in fact, warmer and wetter? And this seems almost like kind of a non sequitur. But did life evolve on Mars, and even more randomly, could it have actually come here? And it turns out that the work I'm going to talk to you about today provides at least partial answers to all these questions. And in answering the first four questions, we actually had something to say about this last one, which kind of surprised us. So let me just before I start out, tell you sort of the general some general facts about this business. And one of the most amazing things that I've witnessed since I was a PhD student is the rapid discovery of Martian meteorites. This is a plot of the cumulative number of meteorites known in our collection, Martian meteorites. starting from the discovery of Shigatte, the first one in the late early 1800s, till today. You see around 1997, somewhere in here, is around the time I started my PhD, there were something like 13 known Martian meteorites. And now we're up to like 34, 35. I can't even keep track anymore. So there's been a rapid rate of discovery of Martian meteorites, particularly associated with their identification in northern Africa, Oman, Saudi Arabia. They stand out like a sore thumb. They fall from the sky. They stand out like a sore thumb right on the dunes and in light sands there. And local people have become excellent identifying them because they can make a good buck off of it. So we're getting a larger and larger collection of meteorites of increasing diversity, which allows us to ask and answer questions about Martian planetary history using a large number of independent samples. Allows us to start making interesting statistical arguments, testing our ideas that maybe were derived from one rock against other rocks. And it's making this idea of using Martian meteorites as a way of reading Martian history increasingly powerful. And we have every expectation that this rate of discovery, this sort of almost super exponential rate, is going to continue. I'm going to be focusing on sort of two classes of rocks from Mars. The first class is the Nachlites. These are 1.3 billion year old rocks. They probably formed in a lava flow on the surface of Mars, or they may have crystallized just beneath the surface in a shallow chamber of magma. These are the seven known Nachlites. They are extremely similar in terms of their textures, their composition. They all have the same age, for instance. They were all ejected at the same time from Mars. You can think of them almost as big chunks of one place on Mars that got blasted off and then have been wandering around in space and all sort of randomly and now and then landed on the Earth. But they're basically from one little outcrop, essentially. And these are their names on the top and then their discovery dates on the bottom. You can see, again, the number of Nachlites has doubled in just the last few years. So I'm going to be talking in particular about Nakhla and Lafayette, the first two here. You can see, by the way, that, for instance, these two guys have this black crust on them. That's when they came into Earth's atmosphere, like any meteorite, they melted on the outside, and that you're basically seeing the so-called fusion crust that they picked up when they came in through the atmosphere. You can even see flow lines, the melted material. So I'm going to be talking about Nakhla and Lafayette, but it's almost certainly true that the conclusions that we derive from Nakhla and Lafayette extend to probably all seven known meteorites from this class, because of their similarities. The other type of rock class that I'm going to be talking about is represented by only one member, ALH84001. It's got a very unfortunate name, so you're just going to have to deal with that. This one was found in Antarctica in Allen Hills. That's why it has that first three letters there. And this rock is bizarre for many, many reasons, only some of which I'm going to talk about today. This is the oldest planetary rock. It's 4.5 billion years old. So basically formed with Mars itself, maybe a little bit after Mars formed. It's by far the oldest Martian meteorite. It's a good 3 billion years older than the Nachlites, which are the next oldest ones. So it's our only sample from Mars from this early period where we infer Mars was warmer and wetter and may have had magnetic fields. So it's a unique sample in that sense. And the question is, what can this tell us about the earliest processes on Mars? This is also the one, by the way, I don't know, this is fading fast in people's memory, but Bill Clinton actually had a press conference about this with some scientists from NASA would argue that there were fossils of 4 billion-year-old Martian magnetotactic bacteria in this. It turns out, regardless of whether that's true or not, those very putative fossils, these magnetite, iron oxide crystals, those are actually carrying the magnetization that we observe in the data I'm going to show you later. But let me not talk about magnetism first. First, let me talk about something that you need to worry about before you even start thinking about whether a rock retains magnetic records, and that is, what is its thermal history? Of course, if a rock has been heated above its Curie point or even actually lower temperatures, you can thermally remagnetize the rock, and it won't tell you anything about the time of when it formed. It'll just tell you something about when it was last significantly heated. So before we started any of this work, we wanted to figure out, well, we know these things were blasted off of Mars. It's a pretty violent process. Is there any hope that they even retain any records from before that impact? Our question was, what was the thermal history of these rocks during ejection from Mars and transfer to Earth? That's the first thing you need to answer before you can go any further to try to assess what they might tell you about ancient Mars. They were only blasted off of Mars, by the way, a few million years ago. So compared to their age, their crystallization age, which is billions, they were just blasted off essentially yesterday from Mars.
Okay. So this is going to be this is probably too much review for most of you, but I figured I'd throw it in there anyway. What I'm going to talk about is actually using an approach that really was intellectually pioneered in this department by a number of people in argon-argon work and magnetic work. It's the idea of using argon-argon dating to infer thermal histories of rocks and also to determine when they were last magnetized. And the idea is quite simple. You have potassium-40 in the rock associated with mineral, a potassium-rich mineral. Of course, it decays to argon-40 with a half-life of 250 million years. And, of course, that gives you an age for the rock by measuring the ratio of argon-40 to potassium-40. And a better way of doing it is to take potassium-39, which occurs in a fixed ratio to potassium-40 in nature, convert it to argon-39 in a reactor, and then you can measure the 40 to 39 ratio, and from that get an age without ever having to measure the potassium separately. So think of the potassium, the argon-40-39 ratio is essentially the argon-40 to potassium-40 ratio. So you have this chronometer. You convert the, you have a proxy for potassium, which is argon-39, and the daughter, of course, is a noble gas. And so it's not unique, but it's one of a very unusual chronometer, of course, in that the daughter is a noble gas.
It's lost very easily by diffusion, and so you can use that fact to place very stringent thermal constraints on a rock that you date with this. Basically, again, this is review for most of you, by quantifying how much of that noble gas has been lost, you can then infer how hot the rock has been since the chronometer started ticking. So if there's most of that ingrown radiogenic argon-40 is left in the rock since it formed, then there hasn't been much heating. So the nice thing about working on Martian meteorites is everybody is working on them other than you. There's a tremendous amount of data on these things. The Nocklites, 15 different studies have been conducted on them to date them with using potassium-argon chronometry. And basically everybody gets 1.3 billion years. Okay, so they haven't been, that tells you, and by the way also, not by the way, this is important, that 1.3 billion year old age is essentially the same within error bars of ages determined from other chronometers like uranium, lead, samarium, neodymium, rubidium, strontium. These are all chronometers that are not easily reset by heating. The daughter is solid, of course. And the fact that this very sensitive, thermally sensitive chronometer's age equals that of these less sensitive ones tells you right away that without even doing any calculations that these things have not experienced any major heating since 1.3 billion years ago. The question is, how major is major? And that's the whole purpose of this part of the talk, is to quantify that. And we were going to actually go and do the argon experiments, not me personally, but my collaborator David Schuster at the Berkeley Geochronology Center. We're planning on doing argon-argon chronometry on some Nocklites to get high-resolution, high-quality data for these kinds of calculations. But it turned out that a group at the University of Arizona published spectacular argon-argon data just around the time we were talking about doing this. And so they very graciously sent us their data after they published it, and we were suddenly a year ahead of where we expected to be. So it was just, this is all armchair geology that relies on hard work by other people who are graciously thanked for it. So we make the following assumptions. We assume all the argon-40 that was lost diffusively from the rock. That the argon diffusivity that is inferred from laboratory data, that applies to the possibly different temperatures and pressures that these rocks experienced while they were sitting on Mars and during ejection. And we also assume that diffusivity has not changed through time. Okay. So here's what we do. We want to know what is the peak temperature that these rocks experienced during ejection from Mars. Okay, that's the hottest time. Of course, they're heated when they come in through Earth's atmosphere, but that heat pulse, when it passes in through Earth's atmosphere, it doesn't last long enough for it to penetrate deep into the interior of the rock. So only the very outside of these rocks are melted. You don't need to worry about the interior, say, more than a centimeter in. So the question is, what about ejection? The trouble is that 30 years ago, it was thought that any impact of sufficient intensity to that could produce ejecta moving at greater than Martian escape velocity, that ejecta would be certainly melted and probably vaporized. That was the leading thought at the time. So people thought there's no way you could even get an unmelted rock off of Mars. But then, in the early 80s, we began to find lunar meteorites. So these are not Apollo samples. These, are, of course, are naturally transferred rocks following impacts on the lunar surface. And we knew they were from the moon because we've been there and we have other samples. And these things certainly were not vaporized, and they certainly weren't even melted completely. And then, also in the early 80s, we began to realize that many of these meteorites that we had in our collection, like Shergati or Nakhla, for instance, that they were actually from Mars, and they also hadn't been melted or vaporized. So people began to think that, in fact, you could get a rock off of Mars following an impact without heating it. But there still had, as when I started my PhD, no real direct evidence of that. And also, no one really ascribed temperatures to that ejection process. So my goal was to say, how hot were these things when they were ejected? Can they tell me anything about Martian planetary evolution? So we assumed that during that ejection process, it was heated to some peak temperature, okay, and then it cooled diffusively from that temperature, either by radiating heat at its out into space or cooling into an ejecta blanket surrounding material. And then during that cooling process, while it's hot, it's degassing argon. The hotter it is, of course, the faster it's degassing because the diffusivity is temperature dependent, strongly temperature dependent. So basically, figure out for a particular temperature history, say it was heated to 800 degrees and cools, how much gas is lost during that entire cooling process, just inventory. Of course, to do that, you need to know the diffusivity is a function of temperature. And then the way you know you select the actual peak temperature is you choose that temperature which degasses the same amount of argon that is actually missing from the rock. And to do this, you need the diffusivity, so we fit an Arrhenius relationship. You can actually, because you're doing it, the way this works is you have a rock in the lab, you heat it to a particular temperature, you measure the amount of argon that comes out, and then you heat it to a higher temperature and you measure the amount of argon that comes out. Then you do this stepped heating. This is, you know, people in this department have pioneered these techniques. And you basically heat it to progressively higher temperatures and you measure the amount of argon that's coming out. And of course, since you're doing this experiment in the lab, you get the diffusivity from the very laboratory experiment. So that's what we did. We took their data, their gas release data, and we obtained the diffusivity as a function of temperature. Now here are the actual data. So here on the lower, they're plotting the cumulative amount of released argon during the experiment. So each of these dots corresponds to a particular heating step, and temperature increases toward the right. So this is a higher temperature step than that one, et cetera, down. So this is the first, that's the 350 degrees, it's like 400. And then we actually, so that's the actual data, and then this is, you see it rises rapidly to the an age of about, this is normalized, but this is about 1.3 billion years here. So the very first heating steps released gas from the very outside of the place where the gas was stored, the so-called domains, which have anomalously low ages because they've lost a little bit of radiogenic argon. But the point is it rises very sharply, and you can model age spectra, as these are called, using the diffusivity that you've inferred. And you can model an age spectrum for different amounts of different peak temperatures that you propose the rock has experienced. And you can overlay them on the data. And then you can do this under several different conditions. You can assume the gas is all held by one type of mineral, just potassium feldspar. You can assume that there's another mineral that's less retentive of argon that has potassium in it, and that's the dashed lines. The point is it doesn't really matter the details of how you distribute the gas throughout the rock. Basically, you find that either the green or the red curves match the data quite well. So you look at this, and the bottom line is there's very little way this rock could have been heated even to 350 degrees Celsius. I'm not going to go into all the details of that, but I can later on. Suffice it to say, we've made a number of stringent, actually, assumptions that make those strong upper limits. So less than 350 degrees C of heating because, essentially, almost all of the radiogenic gas that was produced in this rock remains there, 99%. So only 1% of the gas has been lost. That's pretty amazing for a rock this old. So then we did this also for another Martian meteorite, Nakhla, and we got basically the same thing. then you might think, well, okay, what other data constrain the temperatures of these rocks? You just look at them under the microscope, and they're incredibly pristine. They're fractured a little bit, but it hasn't certainly hasn't been melted. There hasn't even been so-called dioplectic glass produced in these rocks. The minerals don't have any shock features that are indicative of high pressures. And so actually, if you look at the petrography of the rock, and then you compare it to the effects of shocks on rocks as calculated by these guys, Artemieva and Ivanov, and I just heard Artemieva spends part of her year here every year, you basically get a result entirely consistent with what we're saying, that in fact, even more stringent. If you look at the fact that these rocks are essentially undeformed, you can show quite convincingly that they haven't even probably been heated above 0 degrees Celsius by shock. Seems incredible. So that's assuming they start at sort of minus 70 Martian surface temperatures, okay? So they basically have not been shock heated at all since they formed. And that includes ejection. So you can play the same game with ALH84001. It's 4.5, this is 4.5 billion years old, much older. Its argon-argon age is a little bit younger than its crystallization age, so it was majorly heated around 4 billion. But then again, there's beautiful data published on it. And again, you can fit that data by inferring the diffusivity of argon on the rock from the actual laboratory heating experiments. And then you can fit the age spectrum, assuming different peak temperatures during ejection around 15 million years ago. And again, you get about no more than 350 degrees C or so during ejection. And again, that's also consistent with, if you look at the rock and look at the shock petrography, it hasn't been busted up. The glass in the rock is not even fractured. It only takes a few gigapascals of shock, peak shock pressures to fracture glass. Okay, so the most important thing from that, well, it depends how you look at it. The bottom line is these things should retain records of past geophysical processes on Mars. They weren't majorly heated, the Nachfights and ALH84001, during ejection from Mars and transfer. Now, I put this nutty picture here because it also, what we just said is, now let's just go off on a tangent for a second, that these things hadn't been heated above 100 degrees C, say. Certainly not above 300 degrees C, and shock petrography is even more stringent. They haven't even been heated above 100 degrees C during the ejection process. So suddenly we have all of these rocks that were not heated during ejection. And when you think about that in terms of this age-old idea that maybe of panspermia, that maybe rocks could, people propose, transfer organisms from one planet to another, it's actually, you know, it actually provides quite strong support for that hypothesis. If you total up the mass of the Nachlites in ALH84001, they represent more than a quarter by mass of all known materials from Mars. And given that we expect that billions of tons of Martian meteorites have been transferred here through geologic time, and you think you scale that, maybe appropriately or not, to that large number, that's quite a bit of material that you would infer likely was transferred here without being heated significantly. So that's pretty significant from the perspective of where you might think the origin of life occurred. Of course, the big question is, where did it occur? Was there ever life on Mars? Nevertheless, let's leave that point for now and go on and explore the first point here, which is, what does this say about the evolution of Mars? What can we say about Martian evolution using these things? Before I do that, let me just review how we know these things are from Mars. So this is another Martian meteorite. This is a shergotite. And it's from Elephant Moraine in Antarctica. And this guy is only 180 million years old, much younger than the other ones. And it's been heavily shocked, actually. It's been melted. So what I just said does not apply to these shergotites. But that's irrelevant. The thing I want to talk about here is that in the melt pods in this rock that were produced during the shock, which is essentially glass, there are gases that are trapped in it. And the composition of those gases, both elementally and isotopically, match spectacularly with what was measured by the Viking landers on Mars in 1976.
I mean, this is about as good of a one-to-one line as you can ever hope for. It's quite different from the Earth's composition. So this is the meteorite glass composition versus that in the Martian atmosphere. So this is the basis for why we think these things are from Mars. These are young rocks. People have always assumed that that happened during ejection, that when this rock was ejected from Mars, it was heated significantly and melted, and the gas was trapped inside of it. Well, we just argued we had these other rocks, and in fact, they weren't heated during ejection. So there's no reason to think a priori that that happened during ejection. It may have happened while the rocks were sitting on the Martian surface, actually. It didn't have to happen during ejection. But the question is, what about ALH84001? We just said the last time this thing was heated was 4 billion years ago. And that would mean that if there was shock-implanted gas in this rock, that it should be quite old. It should predominantly date to that period. We think that the only way to shock-implant gases is to actually melt the rock, so you need very high shock pressures to do that. So if what we're saying is right, then you might think that if there is gas in this rock, atmospheric gas, that it actually dates back to 4 billion years ago, which would be pretty incredible. We certainly have no such sample of the early Earth's atmosphere. But what would you expect that composition to be? Well, our basic understanding of climate change on Mars is that, as I said, atmospheric loss. And the processes by which the atmosphere is lost are thought to have preferentially enriched the heavy isotopes. So, you know, thermal so-called genes escape removes the light isotope, which essentially has a higher velocity than the heavy isotope. And as well as these non-thermal processes from the impingement of the solar wind, they also preferentially remove the light isotope because of the scale height of heavy isotopes is smaller than that of light isotopes. So all of these gas removal processes from the atmosphere preferentially remove the light isotope. So you might expect that if that's correct, that there was atmospheric loss on Mars, that this atmosphere trapped in this thing would be enriched in the light isotope compared to today. There should be more of the light isotope in there. You also might expect the opposite for radiogenic gases. So potassium-40 is decaying to argon-40, of course, and that's integrated over the history of the planet. So you might think there'd be less argon-40 in there than there is today, as well as any of the other radiogenic gases, because this didn't have time to decay 4 billion years ago. In fact, there have been 8 or 9 studies of this rock. It's, you know, the best-studied rock in history, probably. There are 150 papers on it, of the gases trapped in the rock by many independent investigators. And they've all essentially concluded that, in fact, their gas that they measured, whatever species they measured, does not match the current Martian atmosphere, and, in fact, looks like what you'd expect an old one to be. This is just selecting a few highlights. So the DDH in this rock is 3 times that of the Earth's atmospheric DDH ratio, as compared to 5.4 times in this young Martian meteorite we just discussed, which is essentially that of the Viking value present day. Okay. And same with this. The red ones are all these stable isotopes. So here's N15 to 14. Again, that's lower. This is a less than sign, so it's not great, but at least nominally lower than this, and certainly lower than the Viking value. Same goes for these 2 stable argon isotopes, 38, 36. So you can just go down the line. For anything that's been measured accurately, it matches that idea. Also goes for these radiogenic isotopes, argon-40 and xenon-129. That's actually a short-lived isotope, so it's a little more complicated. The point is, though, that the radiogenic isotopes are less enriched in these rocks than the present day. So it's quite spectacular that all of these independent isotopic ratios seem to be consistent with that model. So at least the argon data support this hypothesis that, in fact, there is an ancient atmosphere in this rock. And what's more, its composition is entirely consistent with what you'd expect if our leading idea for how climate change on Mars occurred. What did someone say about that? I guess not. If I remember, I'll tell you. So that's the second conclusion that we derived from the argon data. Kind of got a little sidetracked, but it was interesting. The third thing is back to the thermal constraints. We showed that these things were not heated significantly during ejection, but you might ask the question, well, let's assume, you know, during ejection, they were
you know, we assumed that they were heated to some peak temperature and then they cooled diffusively. So that took, like, say, a few hours for it to occur, because that's just, these rocks are about fist size. But let's assume that what if we're interested in thermal events that happen much longer than a few hours? Say, for instance, what if you ask the question, let's assume these things were at a constant temperature during their entire histories, what would that temperature be to be consistent with the fact that they've only lost a tiny fraction of their ingrown radiogenic argon? So the point is, these things have been sitting on Mars, in ALH's case, for 4 billion years, in the other case, 1.3 billion, a very, very long time. What is the maximum temperature they could have been at to explain the fact that so little gas has been lost? So that answer for the noctilites is this dashed line here. Turns out the answer is about minus 17 degrees C, extraordinarily cold. And it's just because they're sitting there so long. So then you could rephrase that question. Let's say, oh, well, let's assume they experience a thermal event for, say, 200 million years. What is that temperature? And then you get this dash dot curve here, which, if assuming that a thermal event happened a billion years ago, it's 1,000 here, then you get about, it had to be about a zero C. And it's not a straight line, because the closer in time that you assume this thermal event occurred, the more sensitive gas loss is, because there's more gas available to be lost, because gas is being radiogenically ingrown as these rocks sit there. So that's why these are not straight lines. So then you can ask the same question for 100 million years and 10 million years. So the point is that what this says is that these rocks, the noctilites, could not have been above zero C for the last 1 billion years for no more. They could have been above zero C for no more than 200 million years of the last billion years. Okay, so they've been pretty cold. What's even more impressive is the answer for ALH84001, which is, if you say, let's assume this thing has been in a constant temperature during the last 4 billion years, what is that temperature to explain the fact that only a few percent of the gas has been lost? And you get minus 70 C, which is essentially today's surface temperatures. So this rock basically looks like it's been in a deep freeze for its entire history. And then if you can again play to ask that question in terms of shorter thermopulses, another way to phrase this is, it could only have been above 0 degrees Celsius, the melting point of water, for a million years of the last 3.5 billion years. So only a million years of the last 3.5 billion years, which is quite spectacular. If it's true, there's a number of questions you could ask about this, and the first one, my major question is, do we really know that the diffusivity has been constant with time? And these rocks were shocked a long time ago. I wonder what that does to the diffusivities, because you think that you might, when you produce fractures in a rock, that might make it more leaky. So we're actually in the process of doing some shock experiments in the laboratory to see how that affects diffusivity in the glasses and materials that we see in this rock. It might seem surprising that they've been that cold for that long, but actually it wouldn't at all, this is the other important point, be inconsistent with our basic understanding for climate change on Mars. Because remember I said the early warm, wet period existed. I showed you the picture in the beginning of sharp craters superimposed on a background of ancient weathered craters. Well, the ages of those surfaces is inferred from crater counting statistics, just looking at the number of craters per unit area as a way of inferring age of that surface. Our best guess for that transition to the current cold and dry conditions is actually 3.5 billion years ago. So actually what I'm saying is not at all radical in any way from the perspective of Mars science. It's actually entirely consistent with that.
How do you know when it was ejected? I mean,
right.
Couldn't it just be in space for a lot of time?
People have considered that. So the way they date the ejection events from these rocks is cosmic ray exposure ages. So, you know, you're just producing all of these short-lived nuclides while you're in space, and also stable isotopes. The stable isotopes will obviously accrue the longer they spend in space. So you can infer how long these things from the stable isotopes, how long they've been sitting there. And that's how they get these ejection ages. So, and there's a number of different stable isotopes that all agree, about 15 million years for that rock. A possible complication is that maybe you could argue there's a two-stage history for this thing. So what if it was ejected in a gigantic boulder and it was sitting in the middle being shielded? And you can rule that out, or people at least argue against it from other constraints that I could talk about later. So it's probably a one-stage history for this rock, and it was probably ejected 15 million years ago. The point is they can't last in space much long because they either very long. Because once they get out in space, they either get sucked into the sun, that's where most of them go, or they get ground up in the asteroid belt. So there aren't many meteorites with ages over 100 million years, cosmic ray exposure ages, actually. What's that? Okay.
Tough world out there.
Yeah, it's a tough world out there. So, you know, assuming we can confirm that we've said that these rocks have not been very strongly shocked. So I consider it unlikely that the shock will have affected the diffusivity of these rocks because there aren't very strong shocks that we can permit to have occurred. But assuming we can show that from our laboratory experiments that, in fact, that the diffusivity is likely to have been stable throughout the history of these rocks, then it really seems to suggest that Mars has been in the deep freeze for most of the last few billion years. Okay. So then the second part, it's about 10 minutes. We've shown that these things probably haven't been heated very much since for billions of years. And the question is, when were they magnetized? And what does that say about the history of the Martian magnetic field? This is to review that what I said in the beginning. Here's a picture of the topography of Mars. Red is high, blue is low. That's not water up there, of course. And this is a map of the magnetic field as observed by the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft. This is, I guess I didn't put the color bar for that. The point is, again, these are high fields here where red and green and yellow is low fields. So the Martian, this ancient terrain in the south is strongly magnetized. This is total field. But then you see these two blue splotches here with these radial lines around them. Those are impact basins that are about 3.8 billion years old or so. You can see when you correlate them spatially with the magnetic map, there's a lack of remnant magnetization associated with these impact craters. Some people have argued that that means that there was a dynamo on Mars that magnetized this rock generated by convection in the core before these impact basins formed, that when they formed, it no longer existed because otherwise they would have been magnetized. And so it's been argued that there was a dynamo on Mars at or before 4 billion years ago, and that it subsequently decayed by the formation of these big impact basins around 3.8 billion years ago. So the question is, what does the rock record say? And we have a rock from this time period. Before I get into that, I know you probably all know a lot more about magnetism than me, but I'm just going to review something. I just want to get you re-familiarized with sort of looking at the geometry of magnetic fields. So, when you have a magnetized layer, here represented as these little current loops, and you fly above it, you're going to see field lines coming up towards you. And I'm going to color code those red. And then when you get in between two different magnetized layers, you're going to see the downward demagnetizing field, right? So in my images, I'm going to color that blue. The point is simply that downward magnetizing field does not require that the magnetization below you. If you're looking above an area and you see field lines pointing down, it doesn't mean that the stuff below you is magnetized down. It could be that everything is magnetized up and you're just seeing the return so-called demagnetizing field. Okay? And this is the way I'm going to color code the orientation of fields. Because what we have is we actually have a little aeromagnetic magnetometer that instead of flying over the whole Martian surface flies over a little slice of rock about 1 millimeter in size and maps the magnetic field of Mars at really high spatial resolution, about 100 microns. This is that instrument. Its spatial resolution is about 0.1 microns. And it turns out because of that high spatial resolution, it's also extremely sensitive to moment. So it's about three orders of magnitude more sensitive than standard SWID moment magnetometers. It has a sensitivity about 10 to the minus 15. m per meter squared. And it flies over the sample measuring the vertical component of the field. And let me just show you how that works. Imagine you have, this is what we're going to be showing you, slices of rock, say 30 micron thick slices of rock, so-called thin sections, right? We fly over that those thin sections of rock. Here's, imagine there's a single dipole embedded in that thin section oriented to the right. Here I've shown you the magnetic field lines for such a dipole. And when we fly over it, at say a tenth of a millimeter, we're measuring the vertical component of the field right now. We're hoping to build a one that measures the three components. But right now we're measuring on the single vertical component of the field. Again, red is up and blue is down. So imagine you have a little, say, 100 micron ball of glass. Say, in this case, it's actually from the lunar regolith, but it doesn't matter. It's just something that's unresolved by the magnetometer, okay? 100 microns in size. Here is a magnetic map of that small sample as measured with this instrument, flying over the sample, with yellow being positive values of the field, upward-oriented field lines again, and blue being negative downward field lines. So it's a few nanotesla field at about 100 microns. You can see this is a nice little dipole oriented in the plane of the scanning plane, kind of like that. And it turns out it's extremely weak, 10 to the minus 13 ampere meter squared. So about a factor of 10 below what the other instruments that measure standard moment, squid moment magnetometers can measure. This just shows you the spatial resolution. So here's actually George from the US $1 bill. And it turns out they actually use magnetic ink as a anti-counterfeiting device. Of course, they don't have squid magnetometers at the cash register, but apparently they can use that some other way to determine whether bills are counterfeit. And you can see we can get the little dots on his face with sort of 100 micron spatial resolution. So this is a paper we have that's in press right now. Slight diversion, but I think it's kind of fun. We basically wanted to see, is it really true, first of all, that that shocks can demagnetize rocks? So we actually, in collaboration with a group in France, took a little one-inch core of basalt and impacted it on the surface, actually using a laser. So the laser creates a plasma which expands rapidly and sends a shock wave through the sample. After magnetizing it in the vertical direction, we shot it in two places. And here's a photograph of where we banged it with the laser. And then here's the magnetic field actually before the shock. So this is we sliced it into two pieces. You can see the boundary here. And this is the magnetic field from the top slice, and this is the magnetic field from the bottom slice. So first of all, we magnetized it in the vertical direction before we did this. So right here, you see that everything is essentially red and yellow. There's a little bit of blue in there. But it's basically magnetized up, as you would expect, with this downward blue fringing field, this return field coming down around the outside. There's a little bit of blue, but that's probably just areas where there was less magnetic material in the rock. Okay, so it's just, you're seeing the demagnetizing field that I mentioned earlier. And then if you shock it, you can see that the two little spots where you shocked it are blue. Again, looks like negative field, but it's actually just demagnetizing field. And the top disc is a little more demagnetized than the bottom disc, as you would expect for a shock wave propagating through the rock. So what this says is, you know, it is this idea of, I mean, this is something that people have seen using standard magnetometers, that you can make little Hellas basins, little Martian impact basins on the scale of a thin section. Really, it really is true that shock waves demagnetize rocks. Not any great surprise. But going on to the topic at hand, how would you measure the intensity of the field that magnetized a rock? And the best way to do that is using a technique called the Tellier-Tellier technique, where you heat the rock and subsequently in and out of the presence of the field. It's quite a time-consuming experiment, and right now it's a little difficult for us to do that on thin sections because these are ultra-thin slices of rock. So we don't want to try it. Right now we don't want to heat any rocks, although we're working toward that. We want just some gross measure of how intense the field was that magnetized these rocks. And, you know, even an order of magnitude would be more than I could, you know, that would be great. Was there even any kind of strong field on Mars at all? Was it even within an order of magnitude strength of that of the Earth's field strength? So you can measure what's called the NRM. That's the magnetization as it
as the rock that's natural remnant magnetization. That's the rock, the magnetization as you detect in the rock from nature. But it may be, if you have an intense NRM, it may be that there's just lots of magnetic material in there, and it may be the field that magnetized it was weak. So somehow you need a way of discriminating between the amount of magnetic material and the intensity of the field that magnetized it. I mean, that's kind of a simple way of putting it. And so somehow you need some measure of the maximum carrying capacity. One way to do that is to saturate the rock with an intense magnetic field and measure what's called the saturation isothermal remnant magnetism, SIRM. And then that ratio, now, it's not really well understood why this is, but it gives you a rough estimate of paleo field intensity. So as a first guess, you know, first try, we decided to use this technique. It's typically observed for single domain rocks that a ratio of a few percent implies that the field that magnetized the rock was about Earth strength, say 50 microtesla or so. So let's try that on this rock. Now, first of all, I'm going to skip all the details, but we tried this on a standard basalt from the Earth's floor. Here's actually a picture of that basalt. So here, everywhere you see black is the basalt. Everywhere you see clear is vesicles in the basalt. And there's a little fracture even running through it here. So we wanted to see, can we actually get the Earth's field from a rock we understand very well before we even waste our time working on a rock from Mars? And here's the magnetic map on the right. You can even see, if you blink these things, everywhere there's black, there's positive fields, like roughly. And then everywhere there's gaps, there's negatively oriented fields. So you see, again, that demagnetizing field thing going on. So it's just sort of unidirectionally magnetized, basalt. Then you can say, well, I don't really want the magnetic field. I want the actual magnetization. I don't want nanotesla. I want ampere meter squared is what I really want, or amperes per meter. So you can put a grid of dipoles across the sample. Everywhere you see basalt, you put a dipole and fit for their best fit intensity and direction. What would you expect? This thing should be unidirectionally magnetized because it just formed in the presence of the Earth's field, sitting still. You can see there's this little blue field in the lower right and on the right. It's not magnetized straight up, actually. It's actually magnetized toward the clock, sort of, right? Out of the page and toward the clock. Because you only have the blue on one side. So you might expect, the reason, here's just an image, a field of a dipole oriented toward the clock, roughly. You can see why that is. The blue field is on the lower right, and the red is in front of you. So that's basically what this is, and if you do the inversion, as I just described, this is an equal area plot showing the orientation on the unit sphere of the magnetic direction, with white dots like this one on the upper hemisphere. You can see that's the direction we get, and it matches a direct measurement of the moment of the sample using a standard moment magnetometer that you lower the entire thin section and measure a bulk moment for it. So basically, we could reproduce within our uncertainties the orientation as well as the intensity of the magnetization using standard magnetometers. Then you can do the same thing by saturating it with a field. So here's the old NRM image that I just talked about. Here on the right is after saturating in a field oriented out of the page. So now suddenly that blue field is making a perfect ring around the sample. So it's now got a nice symmetric demagnetizing field coming down. But it's much, much more intense. Look at the difference in intensity here. Okay, so then if you ratio that, then you do the fit, you can do a fit to that, and you find that the moment's pointing straight up as you would expect, which again matches direct measurements on the sample using a standard moment magnetometer. Their intensities match, and if you ratio the NRM to the SIRM, you get about a few percent. Not surprising. This rock was magnetized in the presence of an Earth field, and it's about 1 million years old or so. Okay. So what about Mars? And this is literally, we're almost done. 4.5 billion year old rock, we showed using argon-argon data that it was last magnetized 4 billion years ago. And so it should record any magnetic fields in Mars from that time. So here is actually a map of a thin section of this rock. The first thing you see here is this whopping blue downward-oriented magnetic field line. You see the red lines with, again, the demagnetizing field coming up around it. And actually, that turns out to be the fusion crust. That is the outside of the rock that was melted when it came in through Earth's atmosphere. So that's what you're seeing there. It's very unidirectionally magnetized. And I don't have nearly enough time to tell you about all the petrography and
studies we've been doing in this rock. But suffice it to say, in the interior here, there's magnetite, which is iron oxide, carrying magnetization. And what's important to see is that there are little dipoles, and essentially little dipoles oriented in many different directions in the interior. Okay, so the magnetization orientation in the interior is not homogeneous. It's spatially heterogeneous. That's very important because if you were to just measure the NRM of a bulk sample, the NRM you would measure would be the vector sum of the moments of all these little dipoles pointing in our different directions. The reason we think that, by the way, they're pointing in all the directions, this thing has been heated in some locations, not others. It's actually been brecciated a little bit. Fragments have been rotated. So that somehow jumbled up the magnetization. And if you were to measure the bulk NRM of a big sample, it would be reduced with respect to the true fine-scale NRM. People have done that, and they got the NRM to SRIM ratios about 0.1%, which maybe apply a field a little bit weaker than the Earth's field. So we always wondered what happens if you actually measured this on the microscale and did it on a dipole-to-dipole basis using a map. So here's actually the saturation IRM image now magnetized out of the page compared to the NRM. And you can see we've flipped the orientation of the fusion crust. It's now pointing straight out instead of in. And all these little dipoles that were all pointing in all different directions are all pointing straight up with their perfect motes of blue demagnetizing field coming around them. And you can go and look at those things up close. This is the NRM on the top, IRM image on the bottom. You can ratio them. And both for the fusion crust and dipoles in the interior, you get ratios of a few percent, not a few tenths of a percent. So that's great. One, you expect the fusion crust to give you an Earth strength field because it, in fact, cooled in the Earth's field. But it's also true for those dipoles in the interior. So those dipoles in the interior were magnetized by field probably a little stronger than people had guessed from bulk measurements of the NRM. So it looks like there was a quite intense field on early Mars. The biggest question is, what was that field? Because this is really the final slide here. If you were to walk around on the Martian surface today, you get lost rapidly if you're trying to use a compass because there are field lines pointing in all different directions. And they're Earth-strength fields, but they're remnant fields coming from the crust. So if a rock formed in that, you could have had produced the intensity of this rock, the magnetization intensity. So it could have been a crustal field which magnetized the rock. Nevertheless, since those crustal fields presumably originated from a dynamo field themselves that preexisted, this suggests that there was a dynamo field on Mars at or before 4 billion years ago, which, if it was 50 microtesla, would have been enough to shield the early atmosphere. Okay, so that's it. Here are the conclusions. And, a large fraction of Martian meteorites were not heat sterilized during ejection. It looks like there's an ancient atmosphere in the rock. The rocks look like they've been extremely cold for most of their history, so that if there was a warm, wet period on Mars, it happened early. And it looks like there was an intense field on early Mars. And the death of that field is now becoming an increasingly suspicious culprit in our understanding of how Martian climate change may have occurred. Thank you to all these people who've made enormous amounts of contributions to this work. I haven't mentioned it all because of time, but all these people have contributed greatly. Joe Kirschbank should also be in here as my old thesis advisor. Thank you very much. Apologies for running over, by the way. Sorry.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding something. You said that you could identify these meteors as having come from Mars by the reference of atmospheric or isotopic ratios of gas trapped in glass and
carbon.
You also said these things never got really very hot. How is it you got glass and carbon trapped?
Yeah, and actually I could even rephrase your question. If you might wonder if we said the whole reason we think these are from Mars is because they have gas that matches the atmosphere, and then half my talk is telling you that they don't have gas that matches the atmosphere. So what's going on there? Well, in answering that, I'll answer your question, which is the rocks that have been tied to Mars via the composition of their atmospheric gases are a different class of meteorites from Mars than I've discussed. Those are the so-called shergotites, and they're much younger, and they do have gases that match the current atmosphere. So you might then wonder, well, these other classes of Martian meteorites, which are
petrographically and chemically somewhat different than the Shergottites. Maybe they don't come from Mars. But there are other things that tie them to Mars, other than the composition of trapped gases. And the most prominent one is the composition of oxygen in the silicate minerals in this rock. So if you look at the oxygen 17, oxygen 18, oxygen 16 composition of the oxygen, the SiO bonded oxygen, S-silicon bonded oxygen, its composition of that isotopic composition puts it in the same field of oxygen isotopic phase space as the other Martian meteorites. And it's quite distinct from all other bodies in the solar system, actually. All their classes of meteorites is very different from the Earth. They lie in a distinct part of that. If you were to plot oxygen 17 versus oxygen 18, they lie in a very distinct part of that region. The different classes of Martian meteorites all group together.
Probes that they sent to Mars, like Viking and this little go-kart
Well, that's one of the biggest arguments for actual sample return, because they haven't been able to do that on the surface. The next rover in 2011 is going to be incredible. It's going to be able to measure isotopes. It's going to be able to do direct mineralogical identification on the Martian surface, which all that stuff until now has been indirectly inferred from, say, Mossbauer spectrometry and things like that. There's actually going to be able to do direct mineral identification and measure isotopes on the surface. That's coming in a few years.
And you know it's not from one of the moons of Mars, which maybe they originate the same way as the sun, it's fell off the Mars.
Those things look like Phobos and Deimos. Actually, Phobos is an interesting rock. Carl Sagan wrote a paper in the late 60s, titled which, "Are the Moons of Mars Artificial Satellites?" And that's because Phobos is going to impact the Martian surface in just a few million years. It's had to have been a captured object. Its orbit is decaying, and it hasn't been there very long. So those are captured, probably dead asteroids or things like that.
Any other questions?
The rovers have shown that the rocks are really being heavily weakened. They said basalts, separated, are almost as easy to write into those limestones on there. So I'm wondering if these
the ones that are heavily shocked are. The Shergottites will come apart in your hands if you handle them. So the Nachlites are not, because they are not shocked. So they're quite robust little things. And ALH84001 was shocked a long time ago, so it is also friable. So it's spectrum. And the problem with, I wasn't actually aware of that data that you're talking about, that they're friable, but it wouldn't surprise me, because the whole Martian surface is essentially just a bunch of impacted blocks. There isn't a lot, there is actually, turns out, some stratigraphy where these rovers are, wandering around, but, so much of that stuff is just impact ejected material that it's not surprising that it would be not in good shape to me, I guess. So.
I was wondering if you measured propane intensities from meteorites that were collected, say, from the Oman area and also in Antarctica. Did you actually measure this from both those locations?
We haven't. So you mean Martian meteorites? Is that what you're saying?
No, the meteorites that you measured, yeah.
Okay, so we've only done that on ALH84001. I'm less interested in doing that on these other Martian meteorites, because they're so young that it's hard to imagine that they'd be recording a dynamo field. I would just be thinking that all you would be measuring is the local crustal remnant field where they grew, essentially. So,
yeah, I guess I'm just a little curious. Maybe you might be measuring the intensity of the Earth's field because of the inverse remnants and these things are walking up.
Yeah.
So if you actually checked as a function of latitude, you might be able to see.
I consider highly unlikely that these things would have ITRM, because they shouldn't be, before they enter the Earth's atmosphere, they should be at equilibrium blackbody temperatures that are, 200 and something degrees. So they should have been. They're not going to come into the Earth's atmosphere cold, is my point. They're certainly going to be above the Verway transition when they come in. So it's an interesting idea, this ITRM thing. I wonder.
you know, there should be, you know, I wonder whether it'd be more, if I were to look for ITRM, I would go look in like IDPs or something from the outer solar system. But somehow you'd have to get it here quickly, not heated up during that process.
I guess I was just thinking that if you added the different rotations, if it was measuring the grid scale, then at least you could just prove that the same thing, absolutely no relationship.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I haven't done that. Yeah, and we have to do that without messing it up. And took us a little while to figure this. Yeah, yeah. I've talked to a few people about this. So first of all, we know the way most people make thin sections is they use heat-treated epoxy, which is of course something we don't want to do. So we have them embedded in superglue, and then we're worried about a stressed layer having built up from the polishing, a so-called magnetostrictive layer, and so. Talk to a few people about that, and if you use a final polish of amorphous silica, apparently that's a very good way of removing a magnetostrictive layer. So we've been polishing all of our thin sections with this amorphous silica. Actually, we haven't been doing it. There's an expert in New Mexico who does this for us. He uses all bronze blades, and you know, we have him set up to do this so that he doesn't remagnetize it. But you know, that's always something that. Concerns me a little bit about this. The next step, and this is what we're working on now, is to make a thin section that you can heat. And so we're working on, and it's all going to depend on the competency of the rock. And so we have rocks now that we have made multiple thin sections of various thicknesses. At some point, you're going to be able to get a thickness that you can heat. And we know we've done this already. We've heated rock slices that are a millimeter thick and had no problem doing full thermal demagnetization. So somewhere between 30 microns and a millimeter, it's going to depend on the rock, that you'll be able to actually make thin slices that you can do thermal demagnetization. And the reason you want to make thin slices, by the way, is if you're measuring the magnetization of the rock, you want to be able to know where the source of the magnetic fields are that you're measuring. If you have a thick slice, you don't know, there could be a mineral hiding beneath the surface that you can't see using just surface techniques. So you want to make it so thin that you can see right through it, and essentially it'd be much easier to identify the source of the magnetic field that you're making.
Well, you might be able to do this to take a big slice
The good thing is, this is something I didn't show. This basalt, we also have cores of it, and the direction we're getting from, which the cores? So those were 30 microns. I'm talking about this one here, the one where we just measured the NRM to try to infer a terrestrial plant paleointensity. So that one we actually have cores from, and I think I've measured the moment of the core, and I should check this. And it's certainly going to be in the paper when I submit it. And of course, the core direction should match the NRM direction inferred from the thin section. That would go a long way to answering that concern. And also, of course, the intensity that you infer, the magnetization, you know, moment per unit volume should match pretty well. And at least we got a roughly, you know, terrestrial style paleointensity from this. And it is unidirectional, as you would expect. So it's not like that weird magnetization pattern you see from ALH8401 is transferred to simple rocks like this. And I could show you many other examples, unidirectional samples. So
thanks.